Till Death Do Us Part is a lighthearted and sometimes satirical true crime podcast where we present our dysfunctional married take on serious cases involving other dysfunctional relationships. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the 102nd episode of Till Death Do Us Part.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Melissa.
Hope you guys can hear us right now. We're in the middle of a hurricane. At least that's what it says on the map.
How strong are the winds outside right now?
Between 0 and 1. So for those of you from hurricane areas that experience hurricanes, you know what I'm talking about. When I say 0 to 1, means the tallest trees, you look up at the tops of them, nothing. Not even moving. But it is raining, which is odd. So
I hope everyone's staying safe.
Yeah. So we're struggling. We're hunkered down. We got bottled water. No, we don't have any bottled water.
We filled the bathtubs.
No, didn't fill the bathtubs. So, we're going to record and hope for the best. So, that's what we're doing.
Our female spawn this morning goes, "It feels like Christmas."
Yeah, it's really humid and 75 degrees out. So we're pretty much humid. Yeah.
Because it was raining and we were like just sitting around not doing anything and watching TV. I guess that's what we do at Christmas time.
This must be what Christmas is like in Florida.
Probably.
Like 75, pouring down rain.
Sounds amazing.
I'm ready. Let's go.
All right, Daniel, you got some factoids for me?
Because we're doing something weird, like have an alleged tropical depression / hurricane in California, I'm going to read about stupid laws of California that I guess are outdated. You could disagree and think these still apply, and I might agree with you.
Are you talking to me or the audience?
Both.
Okay.
I'm going to start with LA because LA is catching the brunt of the hurricane, so this is something for them. In Los Angeles, you may not hunt moths under a street lamp. Because I assume that means you have an unfair advantage.
Oh, geez. Moths. LA, come on. Get your crap together.
In LA, bathing two babies in the same tub at the same time is prohibited.
Because of the dirty bathwater?
I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
In Los Angeles, it is illegal for a man to beat his wife with a strap wider than 2 inches without her consent. So if she consents, then beat her.
Are you talking about, like, sexually?
I don't know.
If you consent, I'm just reading it. Okay.
Unconsensual beatings with a strap wider than 2 inches.
Why would they need a law prohibiting that? That should just be known.
Yeah. Like, in L.A., it is against the law to lick a toad. I mean, you know, come on. We must have some decency in society.
Oh, man. How many women right now are licking toads?
Oh, goodness.
In L.A. County. It
must be singles of women's.
Not real toads. I'm talking about men who look like toads.
Probably. In Los Angeles, it is also a misdemeanor. Well, that's not that bad. To shoot any kind of game from a moving vehicle unless the target is a whale. You know, I understand there's an obesity epidemic, but I think that is really pushing the, no.
Burn.
It is a crime for dogs to mate within 500 yards of a church.
In Los Angeles.
No, I get that. That makes sense.
Wait. You can't. But it is not against the law for two people whose home is on the street to mate 500 feet from a church.
No, there is not a law that says they can't. That's true.
Yes. Good point. And some people have seen that lately.
Oh, boy. In Los Angeles, it is against the law to complain through the mail that a hotel has cockroaches, even if it is true.
Okay.
All right. Well, yeah.
Text or email?
You know what? These are old, so I'm going with mail.
I know. I'm just M-A-I-L. Teasing.
Yeah. We'll move on to San Francisco because, you know, someone who's not from California only assumes California is either Los Angeles or San Francisco. That's it. There's nothing else.
And they are lovely cities, and you should waste your money and come see them.
Definitely save up all of your spare cash and only come to Los Angeles or San Francisco. You'll be so happy you did. In San Francisco, it is illegal for used underwear to be employed in wiping off cars in a car wash.
Oh, my gosh.
What? Why? Someone took the time to write that law? All right. Well, used means soiled. They didn't say soiled underwear, just used underwear.
There's so many things I could say right now. I'm stopping myself.
That's okay. This is right up the same alley. Persons classified as ugly may not walk down any street in San Francisco because we here in California have standards, especially in San Francisco, evidently. No ugly people allowed. If you're classified, how do you get classified as an ugly person? Is there a registry of ugly
people?
Folk? I don't know.
You should see what is walking down the streets right now in San Francisco.
All right, last one for Frisco. God. Prostitutes in San Francisco are not obliged to make change for bills larger than $50.
So if all you got is a 50, that's a tip. Is 50.
It's 50. No change.
Aw, that's sad. Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, if you have 100, they can't make change.
No, so then it's even a bigger tip.
Larger than 50.
Okay.
So you just have to ask for two. I get, right? I don't know.
Can you wait 5 minutes? Oh, that's still sad. Okay.
In Baldwin Park, which is a lovely area, nobody is allowed to ride a bicycle in a swimming pool.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
They mean not a filled swimming pool.
They didn't say that. Who doesn't want to try and ride a bike in a pool full of water?
I know I do.
See, so there's that. It is illegal to whistle for a lost canary before 7 a.m. in Berkeley. You're just going to have to wait till after 7 before you start whistling for your lost canary.
California.
Yeah, well, it's fine. In Burlingame, it is illegal to spit, except on baseball diamonds. That makes sense. Because, I mean, spitting is the whole part of the baseball experience.
It is. Right? And grabbing each other's butts.
Oh, gosh, yeah. It's very heterosexual. All right, moving on. In Indian Wells, which is a lovely area of the desert, if you have nowhere else to live, you should live there. It is illegal to drink cement.
Oh,
I rest my case because I guess if you're there, probably have mental issues.
No, you can't say that.
I can't say that. What should I say? Nothing?
Nothing. You just leave it at drinking cement.
Okay. When you play mini golf, my lovely wife, do you ever feel the urge to curse?
Absolutely, I do.
Well, that is why in Long Beach, California, it is illegal to curse on a mini golf course. Amen.
LBC.
So you have to be happy while you're playing mini golf?
Well, most people are
no
happy.
No cussing. God, son of a...
As long as I have nachos, I'll be fine.
You know what is not a good place to play mini golf?
Where?
The top deck of a cruise ship while it's underway.
He's got to turn everything into a cruise ship.
Not possible to... Well, you might play better because the ship kind of rolls a little bit. So the ball might end up moving in.
People are so sick of our cruise ship.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave that out.
Jarvin. What the hell's Jarvin?
I don't know. Who's Jarv? In Pacific Grove, you can be fined up to $1,000 for molestation of butterflies.
Oh, what is considered molestation of butterflies?
I don't know.
Touching them inappropriately?
Is that what it is? Like,
I don't know.
Grabbing them without their consent?
Yes.
That's what it is. That's it. Touching them or grabbing them without their consent. So you can't do that in Pacific Grove. We've been to Palm Springs a couple of times. Lovely area in the summer.
We sure have, especially in July.
Oh, gosh. Beautiful. It is illegal to walk a camel down Palm Canyon Drive between the hours of 4 and 6 p.m. Very specific.
Somebody must have a camel farm nearby and was doing that between those hours. It's kind of unappetizing.
Yeah.
Seeing a camel walk down the road during dinner time.
Do you know what happens if the camel won't move anymore and you have to call for someone to come get it?
What?
It's called a camel toe. All right, moving on.
Did you just make that up?
I did. I honestly just made that up. It's terrible. Don't laugh.
That was awful. That was totally awful.
Yeah. In Redlands, motor vehicles may not drive on city streets unless a man with a lantern is walking ahead of it.
How old is that one?
It said motor vehicle.
Is that before motor vehicles had headlights?
Gosh.
Did they always have headlights?
Yeah, they had lanterns. Okay. The very, very beginning, like a Stanley steamer.
Not to confuse it with carpet cleaner.
Or the thing you should not Google.
Oh, God. We already talked about
that
one.
We did. So don't look. Okay. Don't, whatever you do, do not Google Stanley steamer and then put sexual after it or anything like that. I'll end on this one. Dana Point, which is very expensive, beautiful, exclusive area.
Oh, I'm from Dana Point. Ooh.
South of LA, north of San Diego. One may not use one's own restroom if the window is open.
Okay. I thought they just poop gold. Is so that it doesn't
because
matter.
Then people would see you using the restroom? I don't know.
Oh, California. You're one in a million.
All right.
You're and welcome. We get to call you home.
Very
lucky homie. Us. Stay safe out there.
Yeah, in the hurricane.
I have to stop laughing because when this comes out, maybe this hurricane will actually be a hurricane and there'll be all this devastation. And here we are making fun of this. So,
well, the rain has just begun. So there's a really good chance there's going to be excessive flooding.
So just in case, say some prayers, have some good thoughts.
Yeah.
California needs them for lots of other reasons, but let's say it's for the hurricane.
Yeah. And let's pray that there is not a landslide on the freeway tomorrow.
No.
On 5.
No.
South of Bakersfield.
That would be awful.
On the way to... Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, darling.
Welcome.
Daniel.
Yes, sweetie pie.
You ready for my case?
I am.
Okay, this is the case of Steven and Alana Steinberg.
Cool.
All of my information on this case came from the book titled Death of a Jewish American Princess by Shirley Frondorf.
Okay.
Shirley spent years researching and interviewing most of the key players within this case.
Gotcha.
She did a really great job. So here we go. It was a slow night at the Scottsdale Police Department when a frantic phone call came in around 12:07 a.m. on May 28th, 1981. A man was frantically screaming on the other line.
Is this Scottsdale,
Arizona?
Arizona?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hurry. My wife was just murdered and he walked in the house. My God, please. We were just robbed and my wife was killed. Hurry. I'm bleeding. I'm trying to stop the bleeding. My God, will you get here? What is your name, sir? Asked the dispatcher. Steinberg, don't effing ask me questions. Get here. He didn't say effing. He said the real word.
I assume
okay.
so.
Okay. They threw me on the floor and I told them where to get the jewelry and they left and my wife has died. Just then, a child's voice came on the line. This is his daughter. Please hurry. I'm here. I'm... And then she gave her name. We don't say children's name on this show because it's honestly not necessary. And they are minors and they did not choose at all to be involved in this case. So we do not say children's names.
We'll just say Amanda.
Just FYI. And I'm scared. So she gave her name and said, I'm scared. This little girl was only 12 years old.
Oh.
The 911 operator kept the frightened little girl on the line while another dispatcher radioed the nearest police officers to respond to the emergency on the street of Via de Luz, in the upper middle class area of McCormick Ranch community.
And you said this was in 81?
81. Dang. So it was just the beginning of all the homes in Scottsdale. All gotcha. The communities, like master community homes.
Right.
As officers pulled up to the modest tract home, a man came running out wearing a short robe and with bare feet, waving his arms about and a bloody towel wrapped tightly around one of his hands.
Hold on. There was just an earthquake.
Seriously?
Yeah, you feel it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I just got an emergency alert on my phone saying there is an earthquake detected. Drop, cover, hold on, protect yourself.
Should we stop?
No. I'll check our pool, make sure it didn't drain.
The man was 37-year-old Steven Steinberg. He was shouting that, "They killed her! They killed my wife! There are two of them! They're gone! They went out the back door and over the fence." One officer stayed with Steven while the other two went into the adobe-style home with their guns drawn. They ran into the entryway and heard screaming coming from a faintly lit hallway directly to the right. It sounded like children. To the left was a sunken living room.
Your favorite.
I've always wanted a sunken living room. In one of the beautifully decorated bedrooms, they found two little girls. The oldest was on the bed crying into the telephone, still on the line with the 911 operator. The youngest daughter, age 6, was on the floor, huddled in the corner.
Oh, jeez.
The female officer stayed with the two little girls, trying to calm them, while the other officer headed down to the end of the long hallway to what he presumed was the master bedroom. The door was closed, but light was coming from underneath. He slowly opened the door and saw a horrific sight. A woman in a short blue nightgown covered in blood, sitting slumped on the white carpet, twisted in the sheets, leaning against the platform bed, with one leg crossed underneath her. Her long auburn hair was swept to the side, and the now blood-stained comforter had fallen slightly over her. She had numerous noticeable wounds on her arms and in her sides. She appeared to have been stabbed multiple times. The obviously deceased woman was 34-year-old Alana Steinberg, Stephen's wife of 15 years. The officer scanned the crime scene. The bed was covered with blood, so much blood that it was dripping from the bed and onto the carpet, making a puddle. The silver marbleized wallpaper at the head of the bed had a large fan pattern of blood sprayed across it. The sliding glass Arcadia door leading to the back was open, and three pairs of women's underwear were on the floor near a drawer that had been pulled out of the dresser. Was this really a robbery gone wrong?
That's a crazy scene.
It was frightening. Soon the home was buzzing with not only officers and investigators, but with family, friends, and neighbors that Stephen had called from the den while his 12-year-old daughter stayed on the line with the 911 operator.
So all these people showed up, right?
Right, because he called them all.
Gotcha.
The master bedroom was kept secure while crime scene investigators scoured the bedroom looking for fibers, hairs, fingerprints, and objects that did not look like they belonged in that room. Stephen was still barefoot and in his short robe walking from room to room, sometimes walking outside and into the street, crying and complaining about the pain from the cut on his hand. Some witnesses thought he looked dazed. Others thought he looked controlled. One time trying to force himself into the bedroom screaming, "I've got to see her! Is she dead?" Even trying to sneak in the master bedroom through the sliding glass door, which was a crime scene. So he's trying to get in there to his wife.
But he's the one that saw her and called.
Yes, he's seen okay. the scene, but he was
but
trying
now,
to get in
he
there.
But now he wants back in?
Yeah.
Okay.
One investigator said that there was a level of hostility in Stephen's manner. Something was off key. The officer that had remained in the front yard with Stephen said that his attitude was just not what you would expect if your loved one had just been brutally murdered in front of you. He was passively hostile. Stephen even called that officer an a-hole when he was trying to calm Stephen down and keep him from running into the crime scene and contaminating the area.
Yeah, you would expect most people to have some level of shock and then just pure, I don't know what the word is, loss of control. Like, well, you wouldn't know what to do.
And just kind of stunned.
Yeah. You're not going to have your wits about you enough to be kind of angry and aggressive with the police.
You would think. You would think you would just kind of be in a catatonic state.
Yeah.
The officer said that Stephen didn't seem desperate. It was almost like a show. And that at some moments, Stephen was eerily calm. According to Alana's brother, he confronted Stephen about the intruder's story. He asked him what he was doing while his sister was being brutally stabbed to death. Stephen told him that he was being held down by one of the two intruders. The brother did not believe him. Stephen then held up his cut hand and said, "How the F do you think I got this?" Then later, the two were in the kitchen, and as Stephen was pouring a glass of water down the sink, he said, "Well, there goes 15 years down the drain."
What?
Meaning his marriage.
Well, don't they have kids?
They do.
So that's an odd thing to say.
It was very odd. To everyone else in that house, Stephen was talking and wouldn't shut up. He told them that two men with long hair and bushy beards had come into the bedroom through the open sliding glass door. They were white, and the hair and beards looked fake. The two intruders physically held the Steinbergs down on their bed. One of the men asked where the jewelry was. Stephen got the jewelry for them, and they said that that wasn't enough. They needed more. That's when the intruder holding Alana down began viciously stabbing her over and over again with a knife. Stephen struggled to get free and stop the attack, receiving the slice on his hand in the process. The Scottsdale police were immediately suspicious. They did not believe Stephen's story at all.
Yeah, why would they viciously slice up his wife and not him?
Why would they leave a witness?
No, you wouldn't. I wouldn't think. I don't know.
Why would these intruders murder Alana and spare Stephen as a witness? All for some jewelry?
Plus, jewelry is really hard to sell. I know it sounds good in the movies, but you wouldn't want it because you'd have to then take it somewhere and sell it. And if it's identifiable, no one's going to want it. So
that's what I never understood about jewelry.
Yeah, it's not really valuable. It's valuable up to a point, but it's like, I don't know.
You really just take it to a pawn shop and they're going to give you a fraction on the dollar.
Yeah, a fraction of what you paid for it. So right. Even
so
if
it never made sense.
Even if it's a $10,000 diamond necklace or something, pawn shop's not going to give you 10 grand for it, even though that's what you paid.
No. There was also no sign of forced entry into that bedroom. It had recently rained that night and the grass in the backyard was moist. There was no footprints from the patio and out to the back wall. And if there were two men, there would have been two sets of footprints in that grass. The back gate that led to a park was padlocked, and a picnic table that was against the gate was never moved. But my thinking is, if there really were these intruders, they could have hopped the wall very easily.
Yeah, and this is Scottsdale, Arizona. So it's like, well, first of all, it never rains.
No, it was monsoon season. It was the beginning of monsoon season.
But there might be some lawn, but for the most part, all the other landscaping is going to be like decorative rock and stuff like that. Very hardy landscaping because it's so hot and dry there.
Right. But in the backyard, there was grass. And so that's what they were looking for, were signs of footprints going to the back wall where Stephen said the intruders got out.
Okay. So they're going off of his testimony that they crossed the lawn, even though there is no footprints.
Exactly. There's no evidence.
Okay. All right.
The officers were also confused on why Alana was so brutally attacked. She was a tiny petite woman, barely 90 pounds. Alana was not a threat to anyone, especially not to two grown men. It was obvious to the crime scene investigators that Alana had been stabbed in the back and side while she was lying asleep in the bed. There was a slash through the mattress that lined up with one of Alana's stab wounds. It looked like she had been impaled.
Oh, gosh.
Also, the three pairs of underwear that were found on the bedroom floor were laid out meticulously, not thrown about like a normal robbery scene. Like they were laid out fully.
They were draped.
They were draped onto the floor.
Right.
Two of the investigators noticed strange drops of blood on the foot of the bed that were not connected to the pool of blood where Alana's body was located. The mattress and box spring were lifted, and tucked in the hollow of the wooden platform was a long, blood-stained knife. A meat carving knife, at least 10 inches long. Good quality and very sharp. The kind you would use for a roast or a Thanksgiving turkey.
Right.
So what usually accompanies a knife like that?
The serving fork thing. We got a set.
Ding, ding, ding.
And it is crazy sharp.
It is.
Yeah.
The investigators walked the 66 feet to the immaculate kitchen and soon found the matching fork. Alana had been murdered by a carving knife from her very own kitchen.
Oh, God.
Would a burglar really walk to the kitchen and immediately know where the carving knife was, having never been in that kitchen before?
Not a chance. No way.
And this house was in a U shape, so the master bedroom and the kitchen were on two totally different ends of the house.
Right.
So you had to walk through the entire house to get to the kitchen, back through the entire house to get to the master bedroom.
It sounds very typical, especially for a higher-end home, even an 81.
It wasn't necessarily a higher-end home. It was a very modest, middle-class tract home, but it was beautiful.
Okay. Because I know Scottsdale, obviously, now is the upper-class part of the Phoenix area.
This was very
middle-class
back in that time. Okay. Yeah, like upper-middle-class.
Okay.
And could the intruder have done this without making a noise?
Not a chance.
No, there's no way. And nothing was disturbed and nothing was out of place. The only other person in that house that would know where the knife was at that time was Steven.
Yep.
In the master bathroom behind a vanity mirror, a pile of jewelry was found.
What?
All the jewelry. A pile of jewelry was found stuffed behind one of the vanity mirrors.
That's weird.
It's really weird.
The other thing is you would not take a chance and break into a house unless you knew pretty sure that there was something in that house.
Something worth your while.
Which is why they say most robberies were done by somebody you knew or familiar with your house.
They talk about all those influencers on Instagram and Facebook or wherever they are, and they're always showing the inside of their home. When people want to break into somebody's home like that, they know where everything is, which is really scary.
Oh, yeah.
It's horrifying how scary that is, especially when there's kids involved. Maybe stop showing your houses. Just saying. Sorry.
So I'll just let everyone know for now. We don't have any gold chains.
No.
We don't have any earrings.
No.
We don't have any diamond watches.
We're barely middle class people. We
just
got
don't
nothing.
Have jewelry.
We don't. I
don't have anything valuable like that. Like you could come in and take anything you'd have to take would take a lot of muscle and work.
Tools
you'd have to carry, but then you'd have to be smart enough to use them.
I only have a band. I have a wedding band that I got off of Amazon. That's it. We don't have anything.
Well, that's funny when you say they had a pile. It's like,
yeah, there was a pile of jewelry.
It was a pile, but it was whatever.
Well, it was gold chains, earrings, and a diamond watch.
Mm-hmm.
So it was worth a little bit of something.
A small heap.
Yeah. The mirror was located on what appeared to be Steven's side of the vanity and dressing area because Steve's manly products were on the counter.
Sure.
The evidence did not fit with Steven's telling of the events, but it did fit with the investigator's theory. This was not a robbery gone wrong. This was a deliberate murder. Stephen quickly became the prime suspect in the killing of his wife, Alana. Steve and Alana were married in Chicago on May 29th, 1966. It was a big traditional Jewish wedding with 200 guests in attendance, with a sit-down dinner and an orchestra for dancing. Stephen was 22 and Alana was 19.
Dang, they're young.
They're very young. Both had grown up in the suburbs of Chicago. The couple were introduced in 1964 by Stephen's cousin. Alana's middle-class parents, Barney and Edith Singer, liked the handsome Stephen right away and took him in as their second son. Stephen and Barney were inseparable, and Alana's mom, Edith, saw Stephen as a stray puppy who needed to be taken care of. Stephen's home life was very normal, but his dad died in front of him when he was 12 years old.
Oh, God.
They were wrestling on the bed. His dad had been ill for a few days, and they were just playing and wrestling, and then his dad died right in front of him.
So, like, natural causes, like a heart attack or something?
Yes, natural causes.
Gotcha.
But that was a traumatic experience for any child to go through.
Oh, horrible. For anyone, actually. A loved one die right in front of them.
Oh, yeah. And Stephen says that after his father died, he and his sister and his mom went to live with his mom's parents, and he had an ideal childhood with his grandparents. Everything was very normal. I just don't think they had a lot of money. And he was skinny, and like Edith says, he had one pair of pants and one pair of shoes, and he didn't have a dad. So he spent a lot of time with Alana's parents.
Okay.
And really bonded with them and became part of the family even before they were married. After the death of his father, Stephen did begin to gamble. And This is normal. This is what I was reading, is that this is very normal for kids who have experienced some sort of traumatic event in their life to turn to gambling.
Really?
Yes, because it gives you, like, it makes you feel high. You get this rush.
Oh.
And it usually only happens starting young with children when they've experienced a traumatic event.
That's interesting.
It was a really interesting study. Yeah.
Okay.
So at a very young age, he started gambling. And he was gambling seriously in card games and sports cards. By high school, Stephen's gambling had turned almost professional. And he was good. And he won a lot. And Stephen winning constantly kind of set him on the path to becoming a compulsive gambler.
I could see that. It's almost worse if you're good.
Yeah, they said it was almost like a drug high.
Oh, yeah.
Like they were kind of comparing it to a cocaine addiction where you are just amped up and high and life is great and everyone's happy because you have all this money, all this cash.
I could see that. Imagine that, like you go through Vegas or anywhere like that and you see people sit down. That's got to be what it feels like. I don't like to gamble. I'm just weird, I guess. But I can't even imagine that. But you're sitting. I mean, I can. I guess that's my point. I can see how you sit down in the anticipation of either reclaiming that money that you lost or making more money like you mm-hmm. just won. So either way, you're excited to do it again, no matter what. That's crazy.
Absolutely. By the time Alana had graduated from high school, she had taken business and secretarial classes for 4 years. But she had always been groomed to someday be a stay-at-home wife, mother, and to keep a tidy home, and to always look attractive and put together.
So like the stereotypical Jewish wife.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That was just how you were raised.
Yeah.
Her mother did it. Her grandmother did it. That was just expected. But after graduation, Alana got a job as a legal secretary in downtown Chicago. After the wedding, the two seemed to be doing really well. They did whatever the young couple wanted to do. They went out to fancy dinners, and Alana began buying furniture and decorating their apartment. That was what Alana liked to do, is she liked to decorate. That was kind of her passion. She loved her home.
Yeah, because that was her area.
That was her area of expertise.
Right. And so she's going to want that, which is her main focal point, to be as nice as it can be, probably.
I felt very connected to Alana in this because I feel the same way. I like my home to be peaceful. I like it to look nice, and I like it to be put together.
Yeah, you like things to look nice like that. I mean, you put a lot of pride in your home situation area.
I do. That was passed down to me from my mother.
Yeah.
By now, Stephen was gambling at the track.
Oh, good.
A lot.
Yep. What could go wrong?
Alana knew about it, but at this time, Stephen was still winning. And from the very beginning of their marriage, Alana was the one to manage the finances and pay the bills. She was tight-fisted while money seemed to burn a hole in Stephen's pocket. So she took over that role of being the financial person in the marriage and the relationship.
Well, that's good because the other way around would be chaos.
Exactly. And I think she liked having control over that money, especially because Stephen was not very good with money.
No, like obviously. You said, it would burn a hole in his pocket. So right. He would just rush out and do something with it.
So I think that gave her some peace to have that control.
Sure.
By 1975, the couple were parents to two little girls, and Alana's brother Mitch and her parents, Barney and Edith, had all moved to Arizona. Stephen and Alana followed soon after, but only when Barney offered to open a business with Stephen. They opened a pool and patio supply store in Scottsdale, and it did really well at first.
I would think that would be a slam dunk.
You'd think it would be, right?
Yeah, pool, patio.
Stephen was not very liked by his suppliers. They thought that he was a jerk, and sometimes he just wouldn't pay his bills, always telling the suppliers, "Why don't you see my lawyer?"
What?
I can't stand people like that.
Why would he say that?
Because he was a jerk. While Stephen worked at the shop 7 days a week till about 9 at night, Alana took care of the girls and decorated their new home on Via de Luz. In the winter of 1978, Stephen and Barney sold the pool and patio shop. Money was going out faster than it was coming in.
That's not good.
In 1979, Stephen went to work for Mitch and managed one of his restaurants. Mitch had become quite a restaurateur in Scottsdale.
Who's Mitch?
Alana's younger brother.
Oh, okay. All right. I forgot.
That's okay. In 1980, Mitch opened up a third restaurant and Stephen managed it. Some of the employees liked working for Stephen, and others thought he was a buffoon and had a temper. One employee said that he saw Stephen go after a delivery guy with a knife. And he had to break it up.
Boy, that's one way to not get deliveries.
Isn't that wild? But everything changed once Mitch realized that the restaurant that Stephen was running had never once had a profitable month.
Oh, that's tough.
By March of 1981, Mitch had found a buyer for the restaurant and Stephen was out of a job.
So the restaurant business is bad enough. And it's even more badder than if you can't have profit, period.
Well, yeah, what's the point?
Because even if you do have a profitable business, it still could fail.
Right. And they were popular restaurants for a long time. And Stephen was a popular guy within the restaurant business because he was personable and sociable with the patrons of the restaurant. But just because people are coming in doesn't necessarily mean you're making money to keep the restaurant afloat. And I think he was one of those that was like, oh, don't worry about it. I got it. Or it's on the house.
Right.
Depending on who was in the restaurant at the time.
Well, because it doesn't sound like he's very good at managing money from an accounting perspective. Because usually people that are good at accounting for money are fairly conservative in that they make sure that you don't spend money you don't have, things like that. More like his wife, right?
Yeah, she probably would have done much better running the restaurant and managing the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
At 5 a.m., Stephen was brought to the police station for a final interview. He had been at the hospital getting the cut on his hand taken care of. The cut was actually just a flesh wound with no nerve or tendon damage. So it was barely anything.
It was just a scratch.
It was a scratch.
Yeah, whatever.
In the interview room, the investigators asked Stephen to go through what happened that night leading up to Alana being murdered.
Okay.
Stephen told them that it was a rather boring evening. He had played in an adult softball game and taken the youngest daughter with him. Alana and her mom had taken the oldest daughter to a school concert where the 12-year-old played the flute. The entire family was home by 10 p.m. Alana went to bed first, and Stephen stayed up watching late-night television in the den. He finally went to bed after 11:30, opening up the sliding glass door to let the nightly breeze in. Stephen had just fallen asleep when he heard Alana call out Steve and the two daughters' names. He looked over and saw two men standing over Alana. Stephen then felt a weight on his chest. One of the men held him down while the other began stabbing Alana over and over again. He tried to stop the hand from going up and down and noticed the intruder was wearing plastic gloves. He shouted to the two men that the jewelry was in the drawer. The men then disappeared. He presumed out the sliding glass door. Stephen told the investigators that the men were wearing fake Afro wigs and bushy beards. Stephen then jumped out of bed and ran down the hallway to his screaming 12-year-old daughter. He asked her to call the police, but she said she didn't know how. Stephen told her to dial zero. She asked what happened, and he told the daughter that it was mommy. He ran back into the master bedroom, and Alana had slid off the bed and onto the floor. Stephen put on his short brown robe and waited for police to arrive. But if we remember, he was the first voice heard on that 911 call, not the little girl.
Unless she called and then handed the phone to him or something, but...
No, he's not saying that he called. He's saying the little girl called.
Yeah.
So his story is different than it was originally at the home.
And this was 1981, so that means there was no cordless phones. Everything was corded, and they were... probably might have even had rotary phones still. It's possible. I'm trying to think if
not possible, 81. But they did have the recording of the 911 call. So he's giving a different statement than he did originally, because now he's saying that the men immediately started stabbing Alana when originally he said that he took them to go get the jewelry and then they started stabbing her. You know what I
mean? That's like, a very different story.
Right.
It's not even similar.
While Stephen was being interviewed, his brother-in-law, Mitch, was also speaking to investigators. They were being told that Stephen's little world was actually starting to crumble and that the marriage between Stephen and Alana was not as perfect as it seemed on the outside. Over the last 4 years, Stephen's gambling had spiraled out of control. Investigators learned that Stephen had a gambling addiction and that he was in a financial crisis because of all of his losses. Stephen was used to winning, but his luck had changed and he had begun losing even bigger than he was winning.
Yeah.
Or even bigger than he was ever winning. At first, Stephen had kept the gambling under control, never losing more than the couple could afford to lose. But with each loss, he would double down. And he even started using bookies and taking out secret loans. But Alana, she was the smart one. She was the family bookkeeper, and she knew what was going on. Alana even confided in her family that she felt hopeless about the situation. So this was tearing their marriage and their family apart.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But Alana kept it very quiet and only told her family when things had gotten really bad.
Yeah, because as soon as she decides to make that call, that decision to end it, it's over. Whereas if you could kind of sort of, you know, adjust a little bit, at least then you don't have to face that ultimatum.
That's a hard choice.
Yeah.
Mitch was in the process of selling his restaurants to investors from New York who had not wanted Stephen to stay on as manager. He wasn't trustworthy, so he had recently been let go. Stephen had just picked up his first unemployment check that afternoon, the afternoon of the night that Alana was murdered.
Oh, wow.
And he had recently begun taking real estate courses at night.
Of course he was.
Mitch believed that Stephen owed him, the bank, and Stephen's bookies around $8,500 combined, which is almost $32,000 today.
That's it?
Well, and okay. In the recent weeks, he had placed a rather large bet on a basketball game, and he ended up losing $6,500. And that plus the $8,500, that's $15,000, which today is almost $56,000.
Okay.
So that's really how much he owed was $56,000.
It's like a new loan on a...
on a Civic?
No. On a, I would say, probably if you could get a good deal, a low-end SUV.
Really? 56?
Yeah, but I mean low-end, so it's not going to have leather and all that kind of stuff.
No air conditioning?
I don't think anything doesn't have air conditioning.
I'm just teasing.
You'd have to really search. But yeah, I mean, so I'm... yeah, it's bad, but it's not $560,000.
No.
So to me, that seems still fixable.
It is fixable.
Yeah.
That's the issue. Alana's distraught mother, Edith, told the investigators that a couple weeks before the murder, she had received a phone call from Alana. She was in Tahoe with Stephen and their girls for a family vacation. Alana was in tears. Stephen had just thrown her against the wall of the rented cabin and stormed out with all their money. Alana had told Stephen that she did not want him going to the casino and demanded that he stay with his family. It turned into a violent argument. When they returned home, Alana had forgiven Stephen, but was still worried about their financial situation and voiced that often to her family.
She forgave him for throwing her against a wall and going out gambling?
She did.
Oh, God. Why? I think I'd be calling the police and a lawyer.
Because she wanted to keep her family together. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is a,
no, I get it.
A really, really sad case.
It's horrible.
It's
And ugh. She basically told a drug addict that the drugs he's addicted to are out there, but he can't go out there and get them.
And they're much more accessible than actual drugs.
Right. Yeah. To go get the drug, he just needs to take the money and leave. And she told him he couldn't go do what he's addicted to. So, I mean, I guess if you look at it that way, it's not good, but it's understandable.
Mitch and Edith continued talking to the investigators. This was not the first time that Stephen was involved in a robbery in their home.
What?
In 1969, Stephen happened to be at home alone one night when two men broke in and stole all of Alana's jewelry, leaving Stephen tied up in the process. He wasn't hurt and was able to untie himself and call the police. Insurance paid out on the stolen jewelry.
Holy crap.
Yep. Money had been stolen from Barney and Edith's home, and Stephen was quick to blame the maintenance man in the apartment complex. It was only like $200, but still, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
$4,000 had gone missing from a cash register at the pool and patio supply shop. Stephen had been working there at the time. He blamed the other employees, and the in-laws believed him.
I was going to ask about that because part of the reason maybe the restaurant didn't do well was because he was embezzling money out of it.
Oh, okay. All right. Stephen had also been held at gunpoint by a burglar on a motorcycle who demanded all the cash out of the vault of the pool and patio supply shop. And nobody else was there to corroborate Stephen's story.
Okay. All right.
Hold on.
Here we go. Okay. Here's my take on life.
Okay, well, do you want me to finish?
No.
Okay.
It is not possible that a single person today, today's society, could possibly be that unlucky.
I know. It's not possible. Okay, well, there's more.
Oh, good. Okay.
In the short time that Stephen had been managing one of Mitch's restaurants, there were six separate burglaries of the cash register and in the vault, always while Stephen was working. He was always quick to blame the employees and suggested that each one of them take a polygraph. They all passed. The cash totals ranged from $3,000 to $5,000. Stephen would always file a police report, but nothing ever came from it. And this same restaurant had even been burglarized the night Alana was murdered.
Holy crap.
I know. This is wild. That December, Alana's diamond watch had been stolen while on vacation in Coronado Island in San Diego. Stephen blamed it on Alana not snapping the band correctly. And they got an insurance payout for that. And so on and so on. And this is what I wrote. I wrote, Stephen was just an unlucky guy, I guess.
Nope. Nope, I'm not. No one is that unlucky. It's not possible.
This left investigators wondering, could Alana have been murdered because Stephen owed money to bookies? I mean, there's always a possibility,
but it sounds like he was able to pay him pretty well.
He was trying. Mm-hmm. But why would they kill her? And why would they kill her so brutally?
Because then now there's nothing to lose.
But wouldn't they kill Stephen? Why would they kill his wife?
No, because he ultimately would have to give them the money. Mm. So if you kill the person who owes you the money, well, you're definitely not going to get the money.
So you would murder a spouse?
I would think you'd threaten a spouse or a child.
Or like cut off a finger.
Yeah.
Like cut off one of Stephen's finger.
Yeah, you got nine others. Cut off a toe.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know.
His wiener?
Yeah, testicular, yeah. Something.
Or was Stephen's money issues motive enough for him to have murdered his wife?
But then what does that get him?
Not very much.
A life insurance policy? But then, I don't know.
I know. Well, investigators believe so. So at 5:30 a.m., less than 6 hours after 911 had been called, Stephen was told that he was going to be arrested and booked for the first-degree murder of his wife, Alana Steinberg. For the first time, Stephen actually became visibly upset. He started shivering and, like, crying.
This guy's a wreck.
I'm going to read a quote from the last investigator on the scene of the Steinbergs' home, and his name was Cecil Kirk.
Okay.
The house was kept so nice. Everything was shining and perfect. The kids' room had all these toys and the special wallpaper and a blackboard they could write on. It was just what a kid's room should look like. What I really remember, and I don't know why this stays in my memory, was how neat the kitchen was. When we went to get the mate to the knife, everything was lying perfectly in the drawer. Everything had a place. What was really sad to me, again, I don't know why, because it was an insignificant thing, was that right next to the door to the garage, there were pegs on the wall to hang things on. There was a peg for her purse, and it was hanging there with all these little homely things in it, like Kleenex and pictures of the girls and Mitch's little boy and a little gold pencil. My thought was, this is not a house where something like this happens.
Wow.
I just wanted you and the listeners to get a visual of what this house was like and what the investigators were seeing.
Yeah, so it was a nice, put together, clean, comfy, but very kind of almost immaculate home.
Alana was very proud of her home.
I was going to say organized too.
Yeah. The coroner discovered that Alana had been stabbed at least 26 separate times, all ranging from 3/4 inch in depth to upwards of 4 inches.
I think you would tell me this, but something like that is personal.
It's a rage killing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because one would have been enough.
4 of the 26 stab wounds pierced vital organs. Alana's heart, stomach, liver, and her spleen. She was also stabbed in the temporal lobe of her brain, but because it happened while Alana was near death, that wound was characterized as post-mortem.
Oh, God.
At least 4 of the stab wounds were fatal. Alana appeared to have been stabbed in bed since most of her wounds were to her back and side. It indicated that she had been lying on her stomach when she was initially attacked, which means there wasn't anybody on top of her.
Like he said.
Like he said.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. Alana then struggled with her attacker, receiving superficial wounds to her arms and hands, and tried to get out of the bed to run, but succumbed to her injuries and bled to death on the floor next to her marital bed.
Oh, gosh.
Steven Steinberg was placed in the Maricopa County Jail to await his trial. He was not granted bail since the prosecutor had charged Steven with first-degree murder. He continued to claim that Alana was murdered by intruders in a robbery gone fatally wrong, telling friends and family that he dreamt about the two men every single night. He would pull the murderer's fake bushy beard down lower and lower each night, but Steven could never seem to see the face of the killer clearly.
Well, that's stupid.
Steven's family hired Robert Hirsch, a big-time defense attorney from Tucson, Arizona, who specialized in, quote-unquote, romantic murders. His go-to in these cases was a temporary insanity defense that he had perfected. The kind of defense attorney that would throw anything at the wall to see if it would stick. 10 months after Alana's brutal murder, Steven Steinberg was finally on trial. But when Steven was escorted into the Maricopa County Courthouse in February of 1982, he wasn't walking in with a plea of not guilty. He had actually entered a plea of temporary insanity. Steven had admitted to killing his wife, but said he had done it while in a dissociative state. He had been sleepwalking.
I don't even know what to say. Sleepwalking? 26 times with a knife?
No.
No. That's pretty organized, too, that in sleepwalking, in a trance or whatever you want to call it, he was able to get up, go find the big turkey carving knife from the set that's way up high in the dusty parts of your cabinet.
I don't think it was dusty.
Well, whatever. Anyway.
I know.
Get it. Come back. Not wake her. And then, no. Nope. Zero. There is zero chance.
Steven realized this when in his final dream, he had ripped off the intruder's beard and it was his own face staring back at him. Steven had been the killer in his own dream the entire time.
No.
In his opening statement, the prosecutor, Jeff Hotham, stated that the case was quite simple. Steven had taken a 10-inch knife out of a kitchen drawer, walked to the bedroom he shared with his wife, Alana, and butchered her while she was sound asleep in their bed, stabbing her 26 times. Hotham warned the 12 jury members that the defense would be bringing in doctors to testify that Steven had stabbed and killed his wife while sleepwalking. The prosecution would prove that Steven had planned the murder and the story of the two intruders, hiding the jewelry and taking Alana's underwear out of her drawer to try to make it look like the burglars had ransacked the bedroom. While he was stabbing Alana, his hand slid down the blade, slicing it open. Around the same time, the 12-year-old daughter began screaming. He then had to hide the knife.
So, did the 12-year-old see him? I guess not.
No, she just heard her mom cry out, and then that's what woke her up, but she didn't get out of bed.
Gotcha.
But the prosecutor did not offer the jury a motive as to why Steven killed her, which was a big mistake. The defense was up next. Hirsch talked about Steven's character, that he was a much-loved pillar of the Scottsdale social scene. Steve worked 14 hours a day to support Alana and the children, that he loved his family. But Steven was a man who was run by his wife. She controlled the home and the finances. His paycheck immediately went to Alana. Alana's life was spent putting on a show for others, the most beautiful home, everything in its place, and a place for everything. The jury would hear testimony that Alana would get up at 2 a.m. to clean the oven, and that it was important to her to purchase new things, beautiful things, things that other people would admire. Alana was a rather dominating woman and was persuasive. In order to have all these nice clothes and a beautifully decorated home, one needs money. Stephen made on average $600 a week, which is about $2,000 today. But this was not enough money for Alana to run the household and go out to dinner a couple times a week with their high-status friends. So Stephen gambled. Gambled because of the pressure Alana put him under. When he was winning, Alana was happy. When he lost, Stephen kept it a secret. Despite the complaints of not having enough money, Alana continued to buy expensive clothes, have the house recarpeted, new wallpaper installed. She would look at new houses and new cars and took vacations. The pressure continues to build for Stephen. He loses his job in early May and starts drawing unemployment. With bills piling up, Stephen was suffocating. And on the night of May 27th, he woke up and Alana had been stabbed 26 times.
So the internal pressures drove him to stab her to death without him really realizing what he was doing. That's their defense.
In his sleep.
Gotcha.
Hirsch told the jurors about the psychiatrist's findings after he had evaluated Stephen, saying that Stephen crumbled under the stress and he psychologically broke, causing himself to fall into a dissociative state. There was a breakdown of the integration of motor behavior, of consciousness and identity, and he went into an altered state. He did not know right from wrong. Before Hirsch ended his statement, he told the jury that there was an absence of potential motive presented by the state.
Except that all of the things he did to try and make it look like a robbery gone wrong was very premeditated. I don't think you're capable of doing that while you're sleepwalking.
Ding, ding.
Right? Yes. I mean, I wouldn't think. Yeah. I'm not a criminal psychologist, but I can pretend.
The state called their first witness, Alana and Stephen's 12-year-old daughter. I'm going to read you a little bit of that.
Okay.
The 12-year-old daughter had awoke in the middle of the night hearing her mother scream. And after she screamed, everything went quiet. And I yelled, "Mom." I yelled it twice. And then Hotham comes in. "And what happened when you yelled out to your mother?" "My father said, 'Shut your door right now.'" And I said, "Why?" "And what was his reply?" Hotham asked. "Well, he said a bad word." "What did he say?" "He said, 'God damn it, shut your door right now.' I was going to get up and go to my mom's room to see if everything was all right. And he goes, 'Stay in your room and shut your door, the goddamn door right now.' I shut my door and then I went back and laid in bed."
Oh, boy.
Isn't that sad?
That doesn't sound like a pair of intruders are in there.
No.
If he's saying that.
It sounds like a dad trying to keep his daughter in her room so that he can clean up the mess he just made.
Right.
In one of the daughter's interviews before the trial, she had said that she saw her dad wash his hands that night.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I'm assuming happened before the police arrived. And then Alana's daughter had also said in a previous interview that Stephen had shouted, "Shut your effing door."
Well, it doesn't really matter. You can guess the state of...
But he cussed at his daughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Hirsch, the defense attorney, had his turn to question the young girl. He questioned her about the relationship between Stephen and Alana during this time. But this little girl was smart, and she did not play into the defense's hands, and I'm going to read that for you. Hirsch really wanted the daughter to talk about how much she loved her dad and what a great dad he was, because he wanted the jury to see Stephen as this wonderful man who just snapped, right? So he says, "Would they argue that he didn't have a job or that she thought he ought to have a job?" The daughter answers, "Well, of course, he needs to have a job." "Yeah, I'm sure, but was your mom mad at him because he didn't have a job?" And the daughter answered, "Well, he was mad too."
Cool. So that doesn't help.
And then Hirsch asked her, "Let me ask you one last thing, and I think we're going to let you go. You and your dad were always pretty close, weren't you?" She says, "I was just as close to my mom, maybe a little closer to my mom." And then the defense attorney says, and your dad was awfully close to your little sister, too. And she answers, uh-huh. But I think she was, well, we both were, a little closer to my mom.
All right.
Like, she did not give him what he was trying to get from her.
So the jurors are not going to see Stephen in a positive light.
Or like this really great dad.
Yeah.
Now, that was the last time that Alana's daughter ever saw her father again. Wow. The very last time. The prosecution stuck to the facts of the case. The fake robbery, the hidden jewelry, the 10-inch knife from the kitchen that was 66 feet away from the bedroom that was eventually hidden under the bed, Stephen's cut on his hand, and Stephen's fingerprints on the handle of the knife, and that Alana was brutally stabbed while she slept 26 times. So that's all you need, right? That's your evidence.
Pretty much.
The pathologist testified that 4 of the stab wounds were potentially fatal, but the other 22 were superficial, meaning they were defensive wounds.
Yeah.
The police theory was that Stephen had sliced his hand with the final stab that went through Alana's skull and into her brain. But only the jury never heard that. The jury didn't hear a lot of things, and I'm going to continue saying that.
That's weird.
What they did hear was when the pathologist agreed with the defense attorney, when he asked if it was possible that Stephen had held on to the blade of the knife during the entire attack, causing the slice, but that he never felt the pain because he was in an altered state of consciousness. So what the defense attorney is saying is that that knife didn't slide down Stephen's hand, cutting him once, that Stephen was holding on to the blade of the knife and continually stabbing her while his hand was on that blade. So the blade just rested in that slice. Gotcha. That didn't cut a tendon or anything like that.
That would be tough because think of the force you have to put, even though it's a sharp knife, it's still not that easy.
Well, yeah. And if anybody held a knife by the blade and stabbed someone 26 times, their hand would be shredded.
And it would slide.
It would slide all over because there'd be blood everywhere.
Yeah, your hand would slide down the blade.
That just didn't make any sense to me. Alana's brother Mitch testified on her behalf. And he was supposed to be more of a character witness, and it didn't go very well, and I'm going to read you this. Oh. I feel like I need to really get into this trial because you all are just going to be shocked. While Mitch was testifying, the prosecuting attorney never objected to any of this. And so this is from the defense attorney to Mitch. In fact, your sister was very demanding about money, was she not? She wanted nice things and she wanted success, just like everybody, just like I do, you do, or somebody else does. And as a matter of fact, she did have nice things, didn't she? The house was always very well. And then Mitch interrupts and says, the house meant a lot to her to keep it clean and nice. It was very important to her. And then the defense attorney asked, and it was very important that she have nice clothes and be well dressed and the children be nicely dressed. Yes, said Mitch. That was important to her. Hirsch then asked, and she was very much concerned about the appearance of things, was she not? That's correct, said Mitch. Isn't it true, sir, that if she didn't have money to spend, she would get in a crummy mood, and that's the thing that would create pressure for her? Mitch says, that would be a pressure for her, yes. I mean, it would be for anybody, though, if they had no money. Mitch also said, Alana was aggressive. She's like myself. And Steve was more of the passive type.
Well, that's not very helpful.
No, it was not helpful at all.
Why the hell did he say that?
And the prosecuting attorney didn't stop it. He didn't say anything. And Mitch thought he was being helpful. Like, sure. He was saying, look, she's like everybody else. She liked to have nice things. She wanted to have money.
So the defense attorney's like, thanks.
Yeah. So now it was the defense's turn to start calling up their witnesses, and they had something very different in mind. Stephen wasn't the one they were defending at trial. They were just attacking Alana Steinberg. That's how they chose to run their defense. It was not to defend Stephen. It was to attack Alana.
Gotcha. So by bringing her down, that makes Stephen not look quite as bad.
Right. A psychiatrist named Dr. Donald Holmes, who worked for the defense, testified that Stephen had basically been bullied by his in-laws and that Alana was a lavish spender and Steve gambled to liquidate his debts, which she incurred with her credit cards. That was not true, by the way. She was oblivious or utterly uncaring about their financial realities. When he asked for discretion in her spending, she responded with angry, redoubled demands that he make more money and that the gambling near the end was a desperate effort to obtain enough money to resolve their family problems. The psychiatrist described Stephen as being incredibly patient with Alana. Stephen even described his wife to the psychiatrist as a quote-unquote spoiled, overindulgent brat, the stereotypical Jewish American princess.
Wow.
And then referring to his 12-year-old daughter as a PIT, princess in training. Now, Jewish American princess is a slang term for an American Jewish girl from a prosperous family regarded as being typically pampered and spoiled. When looking up whether or not this was an offensive term, it was equally split.
Okay.
Stephen was worried that if the girls were living with Alana's parents, they would spoil them and bring the two girls up the way they brought Alana up. The family that loved him and took him in like a son, he was worried about his daughters being raised by them.
Well, that's kind of hypocritical, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Holmes said that he was positive beyond any medical doubt that Stephen was completely asleep and unconscious when he walked to the kitchen to get the carving knife and then came back and stabbed his wife of 15 years to death. Stephen is only awakened by Alana's screams. He was in a confused state when he hid the knife under the bed and threw the underwear out of the drawer and hid the jewelry. We can't forget that. Attempting to clean up the scene and create a fake burglary scene was out of denial, a psychotic, not a guilty reaction.
But that still takes thought, right?
Absolutely. And the reason he was not awakened by the pain in his hand was because sleepwalkers cannot feel pain. I looked that up and it's very mixed on whether or not sleepwalkers can feel pain.
Okay. So.
Another psychiatrist, Dr. Martin Blinder, was called to the stand. He, too, was able to basically bash Alana his entire testimony. Nobody said anything, you guys. The prosecuting attorney never said anything. They just bashed her over and over again.
Do you think they just figured that they had such a simple slam dunk prosecution that they didn't need to do anything?
Yes. Okay. This whole thing, them basically bashing Alana, came out of left field. They had no idea that this was the way it was going to go.
But they
never said anything.
Yeah, but they had to think, though, that a defense attorney is going to have to do something weird because clearly they can't defend that he didn't do it.
Yeah.
It's so overly obvious he did.
And he knew he was coming in with a temporary insanity plea. So you know they're going to go for something crazy.
Yeah, it's going to be character bashing for sure.
So Dr. Blinder told the jury that Alana was cold and frigid in the matters of sex. So here they are, they're bringing sex into it.
Okay.
Stephen was a pressure cooker because his wife only had sex with him once a week and was less than enthusiastic. Stephen did acknowledge that in 1979, Alana was diagnosed with cervical cancer and valley fever.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So Stephen did what any man would do. He sought out adult aerobics from professionals for sexual expression, which means he was banging sex workers on the side.
Gotcha.
So if they don't have any money, how is he paying for these sex workers? And I'm sorry, your wife having sex with you once a week is actually pretty good. And I'm sorry that she wasn't enthusiastic, but she also had cervical cancer, and valley fever is no joke. We live in Bakersfield. We live with the threat of valley fever all the time.
Yeah.
We know lots of people who have valley fever.
It's much more prevalent here than other places.
Valley fever is horrible.
Yeah.
You feel like crap for months and you're exhausted and you don't want to do anything but sleep.
And for the most part, once you get it, you can't get rid of it.
No, it's spores that get in your lungs. Yeah. It's like a mold that get in your lungs. You don't just get over it. And for her to have sex with him once a week and have valley fever and cancer, I'm sorry, dude. You're getting it more than most people are getting it.
Probably.
That's what pissed me off, is that they're trying to make her look frigid and unloving. And that had nothing to do with it. And so then he's off banging other chicks.
Uh-huh.
And they're making an excuse for that. So if you are broke, how do you have money to pay for sex workers?
And gamble.
And gamble. All the time. All right. Well, the state was not allowed to ask any more about Stephen's affairs, according to the judge. Stephen even had a woman that he called on regularly, but she was not allowed to testify. Because in a criminal trial, it is not permitted to introduce any negative things about a defendant's past. Those things are called prior bad acts. And the jury never hears about them except in very limited circumstances. But what the state didn't seem to realize was that in an insanity defense case, prior bad acts are allowed in testimony. Because how else could a jury judge if the defendant was insane?
Yeah, because you'd have to have a track record.
Yeah. And they weren't allowed to say anything about it.
That's weird. It sounds like the prosecution kind of slacked off on it a little bit.
They dropped the ball a little bit.
Yeah.
For hours, Blinder hammered at Alana's character and the character of her family. Stephen was married to a monster, and Alana's family had tortured him for over 15 years. The basic character assassination was being done by two doctors who had never even met Alana. All their information was coming from a man who had brutally stabbed his wife to death mere feet from his sleeping daughters. And the prosecutor was not stopping this. I'm like dumbfounded.
You would think that they would, even if it was overruled, they'd still object.
Object to something.
Just to throw the attorney off a little bit. Because he's getting into his flow, into his routine of character assassination. So if the prosecuting attorney keeps objecting, it's going to kind of like interrupt him.
A few of Stephen and Alana's friends testified on Stephen's behalf, calling him warm and loving and an excellent father, telling the jury that Alana had great tastes and liked nice things, and that she was a professional shopper, frivolous and materialistic, and that they believed that she held the purse strings. What does that even matter? One friend even gave the jury a tour of the Steinberg home through photographs, talking about the chandeliers and the closet that Alana had turned into a bar herself. She had done all of this work herself. This witness did say that she didn't realize the extent of Stephen's gambling, but that he had won big in Vegas on an occasion and came home with a Cadillac for Alana. Every other witness got up to the stand and just bashed Alana, from her decorating choices to the sound of her voice. Stephen eventually made his way up to the stand. Through tears, he told the jury that he thought they had a good marriage based on love, but now he realized it was based on money. As long as he could provide lots of money, they were happy. Stephen also said that Alana was a wonderful mother and kept a nice home. Okay, but here was my question. What if she hadn't kept a nice home? What if it was the reverse? What if she was a hoarder? What if she never cleaned? What if the girls went to school with dirty shoes? How would this case have changed?
Would she be looked at as a better person or a worse person?
Exactly. Would they be attacking her character if she didn't keep such a nice home? Because we hear people judging other people all the time about their cars being dirty or their houses being a mess. Anything.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
Okay, you want my quick opinion on that?
Yes, yes.
It doesn't matter how money-grubbing she was or wasn't. It doesn't matter about any of that stuff. None of it justifies him slaughtering her, absolutely slaughtering her, wailing on her, with a big ass carving knife.
Exactly.
Who cares? Who cares how much money she wanted? Who cares how little adult aerobics she had with him? You can't slaughter someone with a carving knife.
No.
You can divorce her if she's that annoying. I mean, if she was that bad, he should have left her.
Well, they're trying to prove that she was horrible.
So it's psychologically.
That he snapped sleep.
Right.
Yeah, that psychologically he broke.
Okay, but how often do husbands psychologically break that are unhappy and slaughter their wife with a carving knife?
In their sleep?
In their sleep.
I think there's like 5 cases.
Basically zero.
Right.
Okay.
Steven also said that he and Alana always had fun together and they never fought outside of the home.
Okay, so then why did he slaughter her with a carving knife?
He also said that he had no idea how much money he had gambled away and that the day after Alana's murder, he was due to meet with the bank to see if he could get another $10,000 loan, which is about $34,000 today, to pay off the interest of other loans he had taken out and to pay some bookies. While Steven was explaining the situation he himself had gotten them into, he was sobbing on the stand. Guess who else was crying?
Who?
Members of the jury.
Oh, God.
The prosecutor asked Steven about the killing. Steven once again saying all he could remember were the two bushy-haired intruders. Then he started crying again, and other jury members started crying right along with
him. But he already admitted he did it.
I know.
So why is he talking about the intruders that were a fantasy?
Because he's saying all he remembers and is intruders. Because he was dreaming.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. Okay. This is crazy. Prosecutor Hotham tried to point out that Stephen's financial issues were not that bad and that he could have asked family members for the money. But he never once asked him about how his finances would change once Alana had died. The CDs that Alana had so carefully protected, the house, the jewelry, a small life insurance policy that had been taken out on Alana. Hotham never mentioned the past robbery where Stephen was tied up in their home by two bushy-haired men who had then stolen Alana's jewelry. The 6 burglaries that happened at the restaurants and the money taken out of the register and the vault at the pool and patio business. That was never mentioned to the jury.
I wonder if it wasn't allowed.
I just read that none of that was mentioned.
Dang.
By the late afternoon on February 17th, the case had gone to the jury. By 10 a.m. the next morning, the 12 men and women of the jury had a verdict. They found Steven Steinberg not guilty by reason of insanity.
God.
He was free to go. Since the judge believed and said out loud that there is no factual evidence and no expert opinion that at this moment the defendant has any mental disorder, illness, or disease. There is nothing to indicate that he is presently a danger to himself or a danger to others. There will be an order at this time releasing the defendant from custody. Isn't that wild?
So it's not like he didn't get the death penalty because of insanity. He just got to walk.
He got to leave. He was done. He killed his wife while he was sleepwalking. Not guilty.
That's insane.
I know. 2 of the jurors walked up to Stephen and embraced him, saying, God bless you, Steve. Geez.
What the hell is wrong with people? I don't care. I don't care. Even if somehow they could prove he did it, I still wouldn't feel bad for him.
No, I mean,
I wouldn't. Yeah. Even if he accidentally shredded her with the carving knife, I still think he should be put away because
Absolutely.
He's a danger.
It's a lie.
Of course it's a
lie.
This
whole thing is a lie.
How the hell? Whatever.
As the jury members were gathering their things, Stephen walked by the open door and one of them shouted, "We all love you, Steve. God loves the sinner."
Stop. They did
what
not say that.
The F. Yes, they did.
What?
Yes. This is craziness.
How did they all agree to that? I would look at them. I don't care. If I was on that jury, I'd be like, I don't know what the hell's wrong with you people. He shredded his wife with a carving knife. He should not walk.
No.
You could say he's absolutely insane, therefore he should serve time in prison. I don't know. I mean, we got to agree to something, but he can't walk.
The author of the book, Shirley Frondorf, was able to interview a few of the jury members a couple years after the verdict, and they still stand by their decision, even after all the other things they had read about Stephen and the sex workers and the loans and all the prior robberies and burglaries. Two jurors even stated that God had put them on the jury for a reason, that it was a religious experience, like they were there to save Stephen. A few said that they still believe that Stephen was a good man and that Alana was a spoiled brat. To say that about a person who had died in such a horrific way, to call her a spoiled brat, you should be ashamed of yourself.
I'm completely speechless. I don't even know what the hell is wrong with the...
One juror still believed that it was possible there had been two bushy-haired intruders in the Steinberg home, that it was a possible mafia hit.
He clearly did it. There was never...
I know. His fingerprints are all over the knife.
Are these people completely stupid?
A couple of jurors interviewed exactly sold on the verdict, but because they were only given two choices, first degree murder or not guilty by reason of insanity.
No, first degree. Yeah.
Okay, but that was the fault of the state. They shouldn't have only been given two choices. They should have been given at least three or four choices.
Sure.
But they didn't. It was either yes, go away forever, or no, you were insane.
How about choice number C, psychotic manslaughter? I don't know. Obviously it's premeditated. And he did it in the first degree. So what else could it possibly be?
I don't know. But even if they went in for like murder two or crime of passion or something.
Man, people are easily swayed.
I know.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why that was the number one criminal defense attorney.
Well, okay. Absolutely.
All right. Here's how pessimistic I am.
Oh, boy.
These kind of high power defense attorneys come in $10 million, right?
Yes.
Wouldn't you already be a little on guard with a defense team that's defending a guy that clearly slaughtered his wife?
Well, yeah, all in all, I believe there were three defense attorneys that were hired, and there was one prosecuting attorney.
But wouldn't that tell you something? Like that they're really trying hard to do something. They're trying to get a guilty man off.
By reason of insanity.
Wouldn't you be very skeptical?
Well, the prosecution also brought in their own doctors, but they were shredded on the stand by the defense attorney. I feel like anything the prosecution tried to do, it didn't work.
Because he was better at playing this game than they were, which is why he was the best.
Oh, the defense attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, but that's why they're good and that's why they make a lot of money, because they already know and they can anticipate and so on and so on.
Okay, I got to finish this. It's getting long.
Okay, well, you talked.
Most of the jurors interviewed still had questions. But this is in Arizona where the jury can ask the defendant questions. But none of them did that. And I wonder if they were even told that they could. Because remember in the Travis Alexander case, the jury members were able to ask Jody questions.
Right.
And they didn't in this case, which is crazy to me. They should have been able to ask questions, and I don't even know if they knew they could.
That's interesting.
Okay, so really what this case came down to was representation. Stephen had the better lawyer, or the better lawyers, and two forensic psychiatrists who were able to spin the narrative and put Alana and her family on trial, and used the derogatory statement, Jewish American princess, in court. They were using it as a derogatory term.
So I have a question.
What?
I wonder how he retained this top defense attorney.
His family. Stephen's family.
So his family were willing to defend him on this?
Absolutely.
Knowing that he clearly did it?
Absolutely, they were.
Oh, God. I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole.
They weren't huge fans of Alana's either. But that doesn't mean that your son should have murdered her.
No, I'd be like, I don't even know who you are.
And his mom, after the verdict was read, was talking to the press, and she's like, I'm taking my son home tonight.
I have another question.
Oh, Lord.
Because I got lots of questions.
Okay.
Spin this back to the testimony of the poor girl.
Oh, I know.
Right?
I know. The baby.
All right. He was of right enough mind and alert enough to cuss at his little daughter to get back in her room while he continued to slaughter his wife.
And to clean up the scene.
And to clean up. You're telling me he did all that sleepwalking?
No.
You're out of your mind.
They said he was awake by that time. But if he had just woken up to seeing himself holding the knife, his wife probably crumpled on the bed and trying to get up and slowly falling off the side of the bed. Wouldn't he drop the knife and start screaming?
Yeah, like, oh, God, what have I done?
What have I done? Yeah. What have I done?
Of course.
No, this a-hole went and tried to make the scene look like a robbery.
Right.
No.
And double down on it.
He was not sleepwalking. He was of sound mind when he did this to his wife. And I don't care if she had an annoying voice. I don't care if she liked to spend money. That is no reason to slaughter the mother of your children. This case is infuriating.
And these jurors are, I'm sorry, they are dumber than a pile of rocks. Because how in the world could you be swayed by this is my question.
I don't know.
How?
This is the most infuriating part, is that the jury played right into it. Later that evening, after the verdict, Stephen went out to some of the local bars in Scottsdale. In Scottsdale.
I think if I ran into him, he might have an accident. Sorry.
I believe that he was expecting a warm welcome, but that was not at all what he received. Most of these residents believed he was in his right mind when he killed his wife. People were shocked that he was at a bar and shocked at his behavior. He showed no remorse and drank to excess. Stephen even walked up to a woman and grabbed her boobs, laughing and saying that he had been in prison for 10 months.
And he didn't get his butt kicked?
He should have gotten his butt kicked. Stephen moved out of Scottsdale soon after, giving his in-laws full custody of Alana's two precious daughters.
There you go. That's never, what a giant steaming pile of crap he is.
Yeah. Never contacting them again. Yeah. Ugh. But he hated his in-laws so much, and they were such horrible people and raised such a spoiled brat, and yet he gives his two daughters to them to raise.
You know what, though? If I were them, I would say whatever it took to get the daughters away from him.
And the daughters did not want to be with him because they knew that he had slaughtered their mother in his right mind.
So the 12-year-old is always going to be haunted by the sounds, knowing the sounds were her dad murdering her mom.
Right.
Always going to be haunted by that sound.
And these two girls loved their mother. She was everything to them, and they were everything to her.
And it wasn't like the mother was a abusive, alcoholic mother that beat the girls, and then the dad came home after working his fingers to the bone to try and give her money so that she could be the spoiled brat.
No.
That's not who she was.
No.
And even then, it still doesn't warrant him killing her.
No.
Obviously.
And I think a lot of these friends that were up on the stand bashing Alana were actually jealous of her and jealous of her home and her daughters and the relationship that she had with her own mother and father. I believe that a lot of it was jealousy, and you should be ashamed of yourself.
Oh, I hope
you are not a friend.
I hope it never haunts. I hope it haunts. The story haunts the jurors and all the people that got up there and bashed her.
Yes.
I hope it drives you over a cliff, because this is insane. You know what it was too, honestly, is I think in the jury selection process, I think the prosecution wasn't very good. So maybe they had new prosecutors trying this case.
They didn't. No? He was a seasoned prosecutor who had won many murder trials, but he went in there having all of this evidence.
Oh, so he was cocky.
Not probably realizing what the defense was going to do.
Gotcha.
And what they were going to be able to sway the jury into believing.
So what I was going to say is, when they were picking jurors, I bet that the defense attorney already had an idea of who he wanted to get on the jury pool, and the prosecuting attorney had no idea, because he figured, well, I already have all the evidence, so it doesn't really matter who's on the jury.
They're just going to convict him.
So the defense already was ahead from the very beginning.
Well, I did read that Stephen had died in 2018, but I only read that one time. So I hope he's dead. I hope he's rotten somewhere.
Well, I mean, someone who is addicted to gambling usually doesn't become unaddicted to gambling.
I don't know what happened. There's no information about what happened to him after this. Some people said he moved to Israel. I think I read that twice. I don't know. Whatever. He's gone.
Wow.
Fun fact. Because of this verdict, the laws changed in Arizona. The insanity defense is a legal defense to a criminal charge. A defendant can be found guilty except insane if, at the time of the offense, he or she did not know that the criminal act was wrong. If found insane, the defendant will be sentenced to the Department of Corrections, but placed in a mental health facility. You will not be able to just walk out and resume your life as a free person.
Wow.
Immediately after this case, the law was changed. So, Daniel, what do you think of my case?
That was unbelievable. That was just nuts.
Once again, and this is crazy to me, you guys, there was very little information on this case. Very little. Nobody really has done this case. There's not any Dateline or any, you know, American Monster, anything about this case. All I could find was the book, Death of a Jewish American Princess by Shirley Frondorf, and I had to buy it from an online used bookstore because I couldn't even find it on Amazon or Goodreads or anything.
Wow.
Yeah. And I also want to give a big thank you to Jenny Abrams, who answered my questions about the term Jewish American Princess. Jenny was such a huge help, and I finally understood that this term, when said, can be used in both a playful way and a derogatory way. Within the Jewish community, the term is used to describe playfully a very specific woman or girl who was raised in the States and is a bit prissy and needs to have things a certain way and maybe even a bit spoiled. But if taken out of context, it is derogatory and considered anti-Semitic. It depends on who's saying it and the context behind the statement. And I believe that within that courtroom, it was being used as a derogatory term by the defense.
Huh. Maybe the defense attorneys were able to stack the jury with people that they kind of figured might be a little anti-Semitic.
And it is believed that they did.
Okay, there you go. That's mm-hmm. my point. And whereas the prosecuting attorneys wouldn't even see that coming. They wouldn't even know why they're going that direction with it.
In 1981, there wasn't a huge Jewish population in Scottsdale.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine.
So most of these jurors were of Christian religion background who didn't really understand the Jewish religion and didn't really understand what a Jewish American princess really meant.
Gotcha.
It was thrown around as a derogatory term for Alana to make her seem like she was just a spoiled brat and drove Stephen crazy and drove him out of his mind with her financial demands that he couldn't live up to. So in an unconscious state, a sleepwalking state, he killed her.
Except Stephen was Jewish as well.
He was.
So why would they choose to be mad at her? I mean, if they don't like Jews, why would they be mad at her and not him? But maybe then, I don't know, maybe they just kind of looked down on Jewish wives or something. Maybe they thought, I don't know.
It was because nothing about Stephen's past was allowed to be used in the court proceeding. Yeah. They weren't allowed to talk about his affairs. They weren't allowed to talk about all the other burglaries that he was involved with. That's and true. Being held at gunpoint, all these other things that he had lied about. I mean, these were lies.
Yeah.
and the gambling and the money losses, all those things, they were not allowed to talk about it. So Alana was made to be the villain and Steven was the victim.
Yeah.
I also read that there is a mini series in production about this story, and I think they are taking notes from the success of the Betty Gore murder case, especially because Candy Montgomery was found not guilty by reason of self-defense.
I hope
so
they
follows kind of the same.
Yeah, thing. I hope they follow it well and don't introduce too much Hollywood into it.
Well, I hope but that they don't just sit there and make Alana look like the villain. I feel like they did that with Betty Gore. I feel like they did that with the HBO series Love and Death. They made Betty very unlikable, and that wasn't fair. Betty was not unlikable. I've talked to a couple of her students, and they loved Betty. Betty was a wonderful woman and a wonderful mom, and she was made out to be a villain. And I'm afraid that they are going to turn Alana into a villain. And she was not.
Even though she's the one slaughtered.
Exactly. Just like Betty Gore was hit with an axe over 40 times. And Alana was brutally murdered in her bed by her husband with 26 stab wounds. And they're trying to make her the villain? That's bull.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm over this case. I'm done. I'm pissed now.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, we got some Patreon shout outs. So you want to do it, Daniel?
All right, you guys, thank you so much for being our newest Patreons. Dora A. Thank you so much, Dora.
Dorna.
God damn it. I can't see. Dorna A. Thank you so much, Dorna. Samantha T. Thanks, Samantha. Ellen M. Thanks, Ellen. Zoila D. Oh, that's a cool name.
I know, I love it.
Thank you, Zoila. Brittany T. Thanks, Brittany. Jenny S. Thank you so much, Jenny. You guys are awesome. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You guys helped to buy this book I had to buy from the online thrift store.
This woman's going to have quite a library of the most depressing. It's going to be the most depressing library ever because it's all just death and murder and... Like, if someone didn't know, they would think she has a really weird reading obsession.
I do, actually. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. It's so appreciated. We have a lot of new listeners, and we hope you enjoy the dysfunction.
And we hope this pisses you off.
Yes. Please, everybody, please let this case piss you off.
Yeah.
I want to hear all about it.
Yeah, and then tell us that we're crazy and know it was all her fault.
It was not her fault at all. And if you were the one that recommended this case to me, I cannot find the message anywhere. Let me know, and I will give you a shout out on the next episode. And if you have any case suggestions, please send them to me at tilldeathdoaspart@att.net.
Awesome.
All right. Well, be careful.
For marriage is a life sentence.
And divorce is always the better option.
Yep.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.